Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
I tried to slit my wrist.
Okay.
Which I was like, this is going to sound so fucked up, but I was like, God, they make it look so easy in the movie.
Yeah.
This is not easy at all.
Yeah. Hi, guys. Welcome back to the Just for Today podcast, where we dive deep into uncomfortable topics with zero filters. My name is Adriana, and today I have Anne Marie here with me.
Hi.
Thank you so much for hanging out with me today.
Okay.
So Anne Marie and I actually used to work together 7 years ago. I was pregnant with Emmy and for a short time, and she reached out to me on Instagram and wanted a safe space to tell her story. So we're going to give her just that. Anne Marie has been sober for 12 years. Alcohol was your drug of choice. Yep. Drug addiction does also run in her family and impacts some of her loved ones. She's also struggled with depression and did have a suicide attempt in 2008, which we will get into. And I feel like even like you mentioned a little bit before, it's Suicide Prevention Month. So it's perfect time to talk about that.
Yeah, definitely.
So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself before we start off?
Okay. I am 48 years old. I don't know the demographic who really follows you, but I feel like I may be a little bit older.
No, we have everything. Okay. All types.
I lived in Arizona since 96, but I grew up in Northern California in a very small town of 5,000 people. Prescott reminds me a lot of the town I grew up in. Mm-hmm. And so my parents ended up moving here and I decided I was just going to come for a summer. I thought, oh, I'll just go for the summer and then move back. And then the end of summer came and I was like, what am I going back to?
Yeah.
I started blacking out in high school for sure. And when you live in a small town, there's not a whole lot to do on the weekends. I mean, I wouldn't say that my friends and I were like getting into trouble. We weren't going out doing like hood rat shit.
Right.
But, you know, going out and drinking definitely was a way to spend your time on the weekends.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, high school is when I started blacking out.
And is that when you kind of realized I have a problem, or are you thinking like it's not a problem? I'm just a teenager having fun, you know?
I still felt like I was just having fun. Yeah. It was a long time before I really sort of like in my peripheral thought this is a problem, but I still was not acknowledging it as the problem it was. Because when you have an addiction, it's not only when you're actively using or drinking, it filters out into the parts of your life when you're sober that are still getting messed up. Right. You're making bad decisions for yourself and for other people involved in your life. I'm guessing because I started so young, it kind of felt normal in a way.
Like it's all you kind of knew at that point, right? When you're starting so young. Was anyone in your family an alcoholic? Like at this point when you're in high school, did you know about the addiction in your family?
Yes. My parents divorced when I was 4 because of my dad's drug and alcohol problem.
Okay.
I really don't remember my childhood before the age of probably 10. So it's weird because I will have memories of things that happened when I was a kid, but I almost feel like it's a flash from a movie or something, you know? But my dad, yeah, he had a really significant drinking problem. And I remember it sounds so strange, but he would tuck me in at night, you know, I would go see him every other weekend. He would tuck me in at night and he would kiss me. And I just thought that's how my dad smelled.
Right.
It wasn't until I got older, probably in high school, being around boys who had that same smell that I went, oh, so my dad just always smelled like beer.
Yeah.
Like it was something that I always knew of my whole life. So that probably also contributed to why it felt normal to drink to excess socially.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that you don't remember much before 10, probably because of trauma.
Yeah. I mean, I think like I can remember, again, like a flash, dad and my uncle. So my dad's brother, my uncle and aunt, they had three boys. So I had boy cousins and we were all at the beach one day and my uncle had a drinking problem too. And I just can remember my uncle and my dad getting in such a severe fist fight that I think in my mind, I thought they were going to kill each other.
Right.
But the fact that they were doing this in front of their children, it didn't.
Yeah.
I don't know if it just didn't occur to them or it didn't faze them because they were both so wasted.
Right.
And that's what they were accustomed to.
Right. It's just the norm. Like what would interesting. So can you tell us a little bit more about your childhood? How was it? Like, I know you mentioned your parents got divorced when you were four and you did mention you'd go to your dad's every other weekend, you'd say.
Yeah.
So what, how did that look? How did
look? Yeah, my parents divorced when I was four. My mom and my stepdad got married when I was six. I say I won the stepdad lottery. Because I really, when you're a child, to have an adult come into your life who is now the partner to your parent, in this case, my mom, it's confusing and it's scary. And he just honestly has always been the nicest, kindest man.
Aww,
so I got really, really, really lucky in that case. When I was at my parent or when I was at my mom and stepdad's, things were normal, like a normal family. Right. I mean, they both worked and on, you know, we all had dinner together around the dinner table at night and on the weekends. I mean, I don't know. We would just go out, you know, day trips or whatever, do normal family things, have movie nights.
Right.
And then I would go to my dad's and I didn't know that chaos wasn't normal. But I mean, when people say drink and drive, my dad literally would be drinking some kind of alcoholic beverage while he was driving. And that didn't ever seem weird to me.
Yeah.
I remember telling my mom as an adult, you know, oh yeah, dad used to do this. And she said, why didn't you ever tell me? I said, because that was normal to me. Yeah. That's how it had always been at dad. So there wouldn't be a reason for me to say to you, oh, dad's doing this.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like it was out of the norm or a sudden event or anything like that.
Right.
But I never felt like my dad didn't love me. Mm-hmm. My dad was never abusive. He could have a temper in the sense of like, if he was working on his car and things were not going right, he would like throw his tools across the garage. And so that felt kind of scary. But outside of that, he was never violent with me. He never got angry with me. He never yelled. He was always kind of gentle and soft-spoken in a way. And so I don't have bad memories of my dad in terms of how he treated me. But when I take a step back and look at the big picture, it does bring up a lot of mixed feelings because part of me is like, how dare you put me in danger like that?
Right.
You know, because I feel like it's a parent's job. It's your responsibility to protect your children. Definitely a lot of mixed feelings and a lot of confusion that I think just became my norm.
Right. Right. Did you have any siblings growing up?
So my mom and my stepdad had my brother when I was 10.
Okay.
My brother and I don't have a close relationship, though. I couldn't even necessarily pinpoint why that is. Some of it's because we are just different people. Yeah. My stepdad never treated him like, oh, this is my child. So it wasn't anything about that. I think it's just sometimes people are just different.
Yeah. And the age gap, I feel like,
right,
could be, you know, you are the only child from your mom and your dad, right?
Okay. Yes, correct.
And then one younger brother. Mm-hmm. So how was your relationship with your mom growing up?
I had a challenging relationship with my mom. In some ways, I think it wasn't bad because I never went without.
Right.
In a lot of ways, I was spoiled compared to other kids, but I definitely never went without. But my mom, and I think it has a lot to do with the generation she's from. Mm-hmm. My mom made me feel like my weight and how I looked was incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And there's some conversations that I've had with her now as an adult, and I understand where that was coming from. You know, a lot of it's projection of her own insecurities from when she was my age. Mm-hmm. I interpreted it as that was more important. Like, that was the most important thing, being smart or talented at sports or other things. In addition, it just felt like that was what I should prioritize.
That's what stuck even with
if,
you, right?
Yes, yeah. Even if that's not what her intention was.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really interesting because kids pick up on everything, you know, like kids are really smart, but it is interesting, like, what kind of sticks with them mm-hmm. and like throughout life. And I feel like that's a really big one that I hear a lot is like, you know, like, or someone will be like, yeah, my mom never like really mentioned to me anything about my weight, but she was constantly like on the scale. Oh my gosh, I can't eat that. I'll be fat. This and that, this is this. And then so even as a kid, you're like, okay, well, you know, you have to look a certain way to feel a certain way, or like to be kind of like proud of yourself or happy with yourself.
And I think part of that probably has to do with that generation and yes. the generations before.
Yeah.
My mom doesn't come from a generation of like women were supposed to be seen and not heard, mm-hmm. but it definitely was a generation more where women didn't have as many options
yeah.
And choices, and men and the male sex dominated things right. in society significantly. Yeah. So I think that in a way they sort of brainwash themselves to think, well, this is what I have to offer.
Right.
And I
right.
don't have a whole lot else to offer, which yeah. is so sad.
Right. Right. Not true. Do you think that has carried on with you, like, for life? Just the comments and mm-hmm. that, like...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I struggle with my weight, and a lot... Part of it is related to depression, mm-hmm. you know? A lot of it is. I mean, it's hard when you're in the throes of a depression to take care of yourself. I mean, like, I told my boyfriend, if you notice that, like, I'm not wanting to get out of bed and take a shower, you need to kind of put me in check.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's a lot of people who don't necessarily understand depression, who don't realize, like, that's actually one of, like, the first signs mm-hmm. that somebody's struggling mm-hmm. is that they literally don't even want to go take a shower.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've struggled with my weight, and I feel sometimes like it is hard living here in Arizona because there's a lot of people who are very focused on aesthetics.
Yes.
It's not LA necessarily, but I have found, because I've been much thinner than I am now, and I found, like, the heavier I am, the more invisible I am to people, mm-hmm. which seems so odd. But I think once people start treating you like you're invisible, you just sort of let yourself become invisible, yeah. which feeds into you not taking care of yourself.
Yeah. And then you kind of just think that about yourself no mm-hmm. matter what.
Right.
Because I've struggled with depression for a really long time. And I mean, one of the topics I'm constantly talking about with my therapist is how, like, I never feel like I fit in, you know, like I feel like I will talk to someone, or like, for example, I used to go to burn boot camp, and I would go there and I'd see like all these people like talking to each other, you know, having like mm-hmm. making friends and all this stuff. And I would just have like this, like, one interaction with someone, and in my head I'm like, oh my god, they think I'm the fucking weirdest person ever. And I feel like that kind of goes to show you, like, the invisibility thing, like, it's yeah. all in your head. And she would tell me, she'd be like, well, why do you think that? And I'd be like, I don't know, that's just like how I feel. Mm-hmm. She's like, but you just said like three words to each other, you know, like. And I'm like, yeah, but she thinks I'm fucking weird and like I'm socially awkward and like all this stuff. But it is
right.
what you feed yourself, and then you start to believe it. And for people that have never experienced that, it's hard to understand, like, how much control that has over us and, like, our emotions and our feelings.
I was listening to a podcast one time, and the host said something along the lines of, we think other people are judging us on the things we judge ourselves yes. about. And I was like, ew,
yeah.
that doesn't feel good. For instance, someone who's overweight, they don't feel comfortable going into a gym necessarily. Yeah. And in reality, the people who are there that you feel are judging you, who knows what reason they're there?
Yeah.
Because the people who are there are taking care of their bodies, taking care of their health, prioritizing their own self-care.
Yes.
Couldn't care less.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that honestly, that's residual of adolescence.
Yes.
Our adolescence is like such a formative time, and we're so heavily influenced that I think part of it sticks with us into adulthood unless we really work.
Yeah.
To kind of break free from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that about the whole gym thing. You know, you're like, when you put it in that perspective, it kind of makes you feel better because you're like, everyone is here for a reason. You know, like no one's watching me. No one's doing all of this. But I feel like I've always struggled at the gym because I just feel like everything I do is wrong. People are watching me. People are doing this. People are doing that. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's like, no, I'm thinking this. I'm doing that. I'm doing all these things.
Right. And then it makes it hard because you don't want to ask for help.
Exactly.
But if you don't ask for help and you hurt yourself, yep. I mean, that's,
yeah.
You know, like you're back to square one.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of us really let fear mm-hmm. of things that are the fear of things that are really unnecessary.
Yeah.
Hold us back from taking care of ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like social media, unfortunately, has a big impact on that too. Cause you see all these like people that do go to the gym and like know what they're doing. And so you feel like when you go, that's all you're going to see. And you're mm-hmm. like, oh, I absolutely don't fit in there. You know?
Right. Right.
So social media can be good, but it can also be kind of not good for your mental health if you're like struggling right. with that.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that kind of like the traumas and all that with your youth, with growing up, is kind of what pushed you to drinking? Or would you say it was kind of more of just like, that's what there was to do?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I think probably once I started drinking, I think when I think back, I think it probably gave me the freedom
yeah.
to just not be so worried mm-hmm. about how I was acting and how others perceive me.
Right.
And I've never actually realized that until this moment. Yeah. So having a light bulb moment.
Yeah.
And I really liked the way that felt, but I couldn't say, oh, I've had 3 drinks. Now I should stop. And that's why I started blacking out mm-hmm. at such a young age. And what happens for anybody who's had a drinking problem, because I don't understand drug addiction, because for me personally, my drinking, I never like was fiending or like had an urge to drink. That just wasn't how I was. So I don't understand how that affects drug addicts in that way.
Even as you got older, like
no,
you never experienced
no,
that.
Like even, you know, I lived by myself in an apartment for 9 years and rarely did I drink at home by myself.
Yeah.
My drinking was always social.
Right.
But it would be like, I'm having a good time. Oh, let's get more shots. That's not the other.
You know.
And then, you know, I didn't black out every time, but even the nights I didn't black out, I would have what I would call rolling blackouts because I would black out part of the night and then I'd come to and then I'd black out. But I did a lot of things that were shameful yeah. and I was very embarrassed of either that same night or the next day, which then, okay, well, I'm going to go have a couple drinks to relax. And as you know, working in the restaurant industry, mm-hmm. it's a place where people like to have a good time in their off hours. They yeah. just do. So I was in that industry for 20 years. So finding someone to go relax, blow off steam, have a good time after work was never an issue.
It's normal, you know, like
it is. And I actually think it's now that I'm out of it, it's a very toxic yes. industry mm-hmm. to be in because it really will just sort of foster your addiction mm-hmm. if you let it.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's just, it makes me so sad.
Yeah. The restaurant industry, there's a lot of young people because that's their first job, you know, mm-hmm. like you're a hostess and like, you know, and I feel like I have personally seen a lot of people go into the restaurant industry and just like completely change and yeah, like almost become like just fucked up and like alcoholics mm-hmm. and that's all their life is like, okay, let's go to work and then we're gonna meet. Cause I feel like every restaurant has that restaurant they go to after work, right?
Oh, sure.
Like,
yeah.
We were at BJ's and it was RTO's or Buffalo Wild Wings. Yep. Like, you know, no matter what day you're working or what shift you're working, you don't even have to have it planned with anyone. You get off of your shift and you go to RTO's or Buffalo and there's someone there from work, right? And like the bartenders know all of us. Like, it's bad. And, you know, you're like coming into the restaurant industry. This is your first job. You're like a teenager or barely turning 21. And I mean, even if you're a teenager, like at that point, they know everyone. So they're not IDing you. Like,
right.
It is pretty toxic. And I feel like, you know, like when you're that young, that's so fun. You have this fun lifestyle. You have this and that. And then like people leave the restaurant industry. And like, there's just some that never, you know, like that just continue on with that because they like that lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Not that they like working in the restaurant industry. It's liking that lifestyle. And I feel like I know I've seen quite a few people that that's happened to. And yeah, it is sad. And even, I mean, there are drugs that come along with that too. Like cocaine and like, you know, it is pretty toxic.
Yeah. And it's pretty bad. I feel like it kind of reminds me of, so, you know, like these hostesses and hosts who get hired or the busboys and they're a lot younger and then they get invited to the house parties or whatever. It's like when you're a freshman in high school and the seniors invite you to their party, you feel like, oh, I'm accepted and I'm so cool. Yeah. But should you be going to, I mean, yes, you're out of high school, you're 18 years old, you're technically an adult, but is that a good environment for you to be in and for them to be including you? No.
Yeah, probably not. And now I feel so guilty because when you started at BJ's, I was pregnant with Emmy, right? Mm-hmm. Before then, I was actually known for like the party house at BJ's. Like I literally would have parties at my house every single like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it got to the point where like managers were calling me out and they were like, people aren't showing up because they're going to your house. And I'm like, that's not my problem.
Right.
Like I'm showing up. I just went to bed an hour ago and I'm opening bar here. That's not my problem. And like it was it, but like you said, yeah, you like invite all these people and it just becomes like a thing and it shouldn't be.
But the whole thing is it's a safe and it's a safe environment. It's better than everybody going out to the bar and then driving home.
Yes.
You know, right. I mean, it's just sort of like this weird catch 22.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. I feel like now I want to do a whole episode on that. Like I'm actually thinking these things. I'm like, wow, that kind of is toxic. Oh, but anyways, yeah. So you said you've been sober for 12 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when I was working with you, you were sober.
Yes.
So how did working in the restaurant industry affect you? Like how were you like, okay, I can do this?
So the last night I drank, I spent in jail. I was working at a sports bar in Scottsdale. It was a Sunday. I got off my shift and I sat down at the bar and started drinking. And I had a rolling blackout night, so I don't remember what happened. I know that I had enough sense to make sure my keys were not on me or anywhere near my vehicle so that I couldn't try to drive, which I don't think I would have, but also couldn't get arrested for DUI.
Right.
Because for people who don't know, you don't just have to be driving a vehicle to get a DUI if you're intoxicated.
Yeah, you just have to be sitting in your vehicle.
Yes. So I know my manager at the sports bar called the police because I think she just didn't really know what to do. Right. So I think I was arrested for public intoxication because I was talking about wanting to kill myself. And I think it really scared her.
Yeah.
She didn't know what to do. So they took me to jail in Scottsdale for the night. I mean, that's where. And then the next day I called my mom and she came and got me. And I want to say the first thing she said when I got in the car was, you know, you have to stop drinking, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, yes.
Did you ever have any other problems like with the law before that?
Oh, yeah. I got a DUI. So I had moved to Arizona in 96, but then I moved back to California, the San Diego area for about a year and a half.
Okay. How old were you at that time?
Oh, 28, I think. And I got a DUI while I was living out there.
Okay.
So, yes. But, and there was another time the police got involved because from what I was told, people saw me in a parking lot get picked up by people, left, and then they saw me brought back by the same vehicle, but my clothes were not on me the way they were when I left.
Okay.
And so the police were called and I think I was taken in for a mental evaluation.
Okay.
But I could.
So no, you don't remember that time
at all whatsoever.
Or nothing. Who you were with?
Nope.
Or
Nothing.
Huh. That's interesting. So does it ever, do you ever think like, was I raped? Was I?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm sure I was.
Yeah.
I think it would be naive not to think that I was, you right. know, because unfortunately not everybody is going to see an intoxicated woman by themselves and think, I need to help her.
Yes.
Like, let me figure out what I need to do to help right. her. They're going to do what they consider have a good time
right.
with this person who, well, she doesn't know anyway, so yeah. what does it matter?
And if she's agreeing, it doesn't matter. She's intoxicated, right. you know, all this. Right.
And that was probably in like 2004, somewhere around 2004 to 2006.
Okay. And after any of these incidences, did you think to yourself, I need to stop? Or was it still just like, I'm just having fun?
No, because I would have a lot of guilt and a lot of shame.
Okay.
But it wasn't enough to get me to quit. And I actually... I told you the wrong date. I tried to kill myself in 2007, not 2008.
Okay.
So when I tried to take my life in 2007 and I got out of the hospital, I got sober and I was sober for 2 years from 2007 to 2009.
Okay.
And then I started drinking again. And in 2013 is when I finally was like, I can't drink anymore.
Okay.
And the first time I got sober in 2007, I actually went to AA. Yeah. I had a sponsor. I was working the steps. In AA, your sober anniversary, they call it your birthday. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that. Mm-hmm. Or
I didn't know that.
So they call the day you're born your belly button birthday because
okay.
of the umbilical cord.
Yeah.
But when you have your sobriety dates, it's your birthday. And my sponsor didn't acknowledge my 1 year birthday.
Hmm.
And I was not strong enough as a person and my own character to tell her how hurt I was.
Right.
I just sort of distanced myself from her. And then I still stayed in AA for another year, but I think that happening and me not having that same kind of relationship with my sponsor, I just allowed myself to kind of drift farther and farther right. away from sobriety and ended up drinking again.
Yeah. Do you ever think that, I'm just thinking, because I remember like Eric would talk to me about, you know, NA and stuff like that and like rehabs, and he was not a fan. He didn't like going to like rehabs and all these things, but I think it was because like before I met him, he had gone to, I think, like probably a handful to dozens of rehabs and all these places, but it was forced. So it was like because of like, you know, court appointed or like all these things. So it just left a bad taste in his mouth. And he's like, I don't want to do it. Like, I just feel like I've been forced to do all these things. I don't like it. He absolutely hated dates. Counting dates.
Okay.
So he didn't do, like, I remember the first time I went through like a detox with him and like, you know, we're starting over. I remember one time I like made a comment and I was like, oh my, you haven't used for like a whole month. It's been a whole month. And that's when he was like, I hate that. He's like, I don't like counting dates. I don't like doing this. I don't like doing that because it makes like, if someone has just one slip up, like one slip up for a day, he's like, it just makes them feel like shit, like going from 3 years and now I'm back to one day. And he was like, then I would just have this mentality of like, okay, well, I just gave all that up. So why am I going to start over? Like, you know, like, what do you think about that?
So
I know everyone's so different.
Funny, right. And what's so funny is there have been times where I've wanted to drink because, you know, like when we worked in the restaurant industry, if you had a tough night at work, you would get off work and be like, I need a fucking drink.
Yes.
Like, so there have been times because now I don't have a coping mechanism.
Right.
I drank alcohol to cope with things I didn't want to actually feel or deal with. And I didn't, you know, once you get sober, you don't have that anymore. Right. So there have been times where I've been like, oh, I really want to drink.
Yeah.
But my pride is like, and then I'm going to throw 12 years down.
So it helps you.
It does.
Yeah.
It
so
does.
That just goes, you know, to show how funny it is because everyone's so different.
And I think that could be one of the things. Like I said, I don't understand that like compulsion to want to use.
Right.
And I'm not saying that that's how it is for everybody who's had a drinking problem. I'm just saying for me, it was never like that. So I don't know if that is one of the big differences. I can kind of understand his perspective.
Yeah.
Because there is, when you're trying to get sober and stay sober, like there's a lot of weight riding on you because you feel it yourself and you know there's other people who are counting on you.
Right.
You know, but I think what you don't understand is those people counting on you to stay sober is because they care so damn much.
Yeah.
It's, It's that they just want to see you succeed.
Right.
More than anything.
Right.
As opposed to wanting to shame you because you
did this or made this one mistake. Yeah.
Right.
I think that's like a big thing too, is like the guilt you feel for letting these people down, or, you know, like you don't want to do this because then you feel like a disappointment and all of this stuff.
For people who knew me when I was drinking at my heaviest, they know like what an accomplishment it is now that I don't drink.
Right.
And so there also is that as well, not wanting to let people down, but really I'd say more that I'm like, so I'm going to throw 12 years away and then I have to start over on day one.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
It's not worth it.
And I guess, you know, everyone finds what works for them. So it's great that that is like kind of a new way to cope. Not really, but like, I guess, telling yourself that. And if it works, then that's great.
And, you know, I know the reason behind why you picked Just for Today. And I remember in the early days of me going to AA, I was at a meeting one time and someone who'd been in for probably like 30 or more years, they said, you know, just say to yourself, I'm not going to drink today.
Yeah.
As far as tomorrow, I'll worry about it when I get there.
Yeah.
And so, because when you think to yourself, and I'm sure, well, I can't say for certain, but Eric probably had the same thought, like, oh my God, I can never drink again.
Yeah. It's a law.
Like when I got sober, I was 36. I was 36 or 37. That's still pretty young.
Yeah.
You know, but I had done so much destruction to myself as a person, to my life as a whole, to people who cared about me.
Yep.
Like, yeah, that's a long time not to drink, but that's also a long time to continue to wreak havoc.
Yeah, that's one. And I feel like that also, though, kind of plays into the way you said, like, you never had that, like, oh my gosh, like the, like that really deep urge, mm-hmm. like you need to drink.
Right.
So I feel like that's also, like, that shows, because you're thinking the opposite way, like, okay, but that's also a really long time to, like, not, you know, fuck things up.
Right.
But, you know, looking at it from the other perspective, when someone has this urge and they're like, oh my God, I can't do that forever. Like, I use that saying for everything, but one of the main ones that I use it for is, like, I have to live without Eric for the rest of my life. And when I sit down and think about it, like, I can't think about it a lot right now because I will. What? Like, I'm never going to see him again for the rest of my life. So I really do have to, like, when I get in those moments of that, like, shit, he's really dead. I do have to tell myself, okay, just for today, like, you're not going to live with him just for today. And you have to look at it one day at a time because it is hard. Like, when you love something or when you're addicted to something and you want something, like, a full lifetime, that's crazy.
Yeah. And I'm sure people would say to you, like, what do you mean you have to go, you have to realize he's dead?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because I think when you've been through something really traumatic, I don't think that you get used to that. Mm-hmm. You just get used to that things are different now.
Yeah.
Okay, things are different, but no, I'm not, I haven't. Like, part of me is never going to accept that this person's gone.
No, I feel like there is a part of you, like, I can show you my call log right now, and I called Eric last night because in that split second, I had something I wanted to tell him, and I literally just thought, he was a phone call away.
Right.
And then it, like, goes to, oh, this number is no longer in service. And I'm like, shit, like, what the fuck? Like, it's just habit. Like, I, you know, like something happened and I wanted to call him and tell him. And, you know, like, it's not something you constantly think of. So it's just, it's weird. But yeah, so let's talk about you go to jail in Scottsdale. Mm-hmm. You wake up. And that's, would you say that was like your rock bottom where you're like, I'm absolutely done?
I woke up and I was like, oh, last night was real bad. All right. Clearly I don't have a job anymore. Okay. All right. So then how am I going to pay? You know, and at the time I was living in an apartment by myself, no roommate, nothing. I was like, okay, now what? So I called my mom to pick me up.
Did you ever go through a detox?
No.
No? Okay.
No. Hi. And the second time I got sober, so I've been sober for 12 years, I have not done AA.
Wow. Do you think it left like a bad taste in your mouth that your sponsor kind of just...
I don't know that it left a bad taste in my mouth. I think that my first time around, there was a lot of value. You know, there's something that a woman said in a meeting one time and it has stuck with me forever. And she goes, nobody ever died from being uncomfortable. And I think that applies to so many parts of life because I think we live in a world where people will do whatever they can to not feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. They will... Whereas I feel like if you would allow yourself to sit with some uncomfortability or some boredom sometimes, you would learn it's not that bad. Yeah. And you kind of learn how to, I don't know, better coping skills.
Yeah. You learn a lot about yourself.
Yeah. Too. And the other thing, when you get sober, your social circle changes mm-hmm. drastically. So for the people that don't have a drinking problem, they will sort of still stick around because hanging out with you not drinking or drinking doesn't matter.
Right.
And the people who also had drinking problems, it's probably not going to work so well.
Yeah.
So I think the first time around AA was good because I now had, you know, a social network and then a support system in one.
Right.
It felt like that's what I needed. The second time around, I don't know what it is. I knew I could go. I knew if I ever wanted to go, I could. I mean, right. for anybody who says, well, I can't find a meeting, I must say bullshit. It is a great community, but I will say this, it can be tough to find a meeting that you feel like you fit in for various reasons. Yeah. So I'm not sure what it is. I think I just tried to, I mean, initially I was just so embarrassed. Like I had gotten to this level of intoxication at my place of employment. And granted, it was a sports bar and most people there drank quite a few to excess. So that wasn't the big deal. It was that this employee drank to excess and then was wanting to end her life.
Right.
And I think in that time, probably end my life because I was embarrassed that I was so drunk at work, which is what I call situational depression or like situational suicide as opposed to like, you know, having actual like suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think because I knew like it was always going to be there. It wasn't going to go anywhere. If I wanted to go to AA, I could at any time, but I knew I needed to really focus on some other things. Like, yes, drinking was a big problem, but there were much bigger issues that were contributing to the problems in my life that didn't have to do with alcohol. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's probably a bigger reason why I didn't go to AA the second time around.
And like dealing with those problems. What would you say were some of those, like the bigger ones?
So one of the things that I've always had a terrible relationship with is money. And I do think a big part of that is because of being an alcoholic, because I didn't have problems in my life only when I was drinking. I mean, it filtered out into my the times when I was sober. I would still not make great choices for myself. I was still not making choices where I was respecting myself. Really made bad choices financially, which would make me feel shameful. And then, you know, I would maybe go drink to feel better about that. I also didn't take care of myself like physically, and I was completely ignoring my mental health. You know, now I'm on medication, which do I know I'll be on medication for the rest of my life? No, but if I am, that's okay.
Yeah.
But I wasn't trying to do that. And so I'm using coping mechanism, alcohol, which is a depressant to help my depression.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, doesn't make any sense. That reminds me, oh my gosh, I read something one time and it was like, you go to a club to drink alcohol, which is a downer, right? But you're like at this club where it's all loud and blah, blah, blah. And then you go to a coffee shop to drink coffee and it's like quiet and this and that, but the coffee's supposed to be like an upper. So like when I read that, I was like, oh my God, that's so true. But it's true. Like, man, especially if you already struggle with depression, alcohol does not help you, but it does feel good in the moment.
I don't think I was in one of my periods of very suicidal the second time I got sober. The first time I was in a real bad place, which is why I tried to take my life.
Let's talk about that. When you attempted suicide while you were sober, right?
No,
were not sober yet.
No.
Okay.
So I went out one night. I went out with my brother and some of his friends.
Okay.
And had a rolling blackout night. It was one of the times when I came to, and I knew whatever I'd done, I was embarrassed about. And so I just needed to get away. And so I shouldn't have driven, but I did. I drove to my apartment. I went into the kitchen and got a knife and I got in my car. And I was pretty set on ending my life because I remember I sent quite a few people in my phone text messages saying goodbye. A very close friend She lived in Ohio, and I left her a voicemail on her work phone.
Oh, man.
Because I knew if I called her on her cell phone, she would answer.
Right.
So I left her a message on her work phone saying goodbye, saying how sorry I was that I wouldn't be there. She has three girls now, but at the time she just had her oldest daughter. How sorry I was I wouldn't be there to see her daughter grow up, all of these things. I thought, all right, well, where am I going to go? I don't want to be near people. I know people in San Diego. I know people in the Phoenix area. I don't know anybody in Tucson. Mm-hmm. So I started to drive.
And you're drunk, right?
I'm drunk.
Okay.
And before I had gone on this drive, I tried to slit my wrist.
Okay.
Which I was like, this is going to sound so fucked up, but I was like, God, they make it look so easy in the movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is not easy at all.
Yeah.
I started driving towards Tucson, and I don't know if I was just exhausted mentally and emotionally, or if I was literally like exhausted because like I was intoxicated. Okay. So I pulled over at a rest stop and I took my keys out of the car and I put them under the car. Okay. Which is, I'd said earlier, like,
yeah.
Because I knew I would get, if my car, even though they're not in the ignition, if they're anywhere in the car, I was like, I'm going to get a DUI.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And I got out of my car and I had taken a hand towel when I left my apartment and I just had it on my wrist. I would say probably the nicest DPS officer on the planet pulled over and he just started talking to me. Just asking me like how I was, what was going on, just having a conversation with mm-hmm. me. And he finally got to the point. He said, well, is there someone I can call? Cause I, you know, I'd like to help you. Mm-hmm. And so I said, yeah, you can call my mom.
And at this point, are you telling him like,
oh, he knew.
Well, he could see.
Yes. And he asked me, he goes, do you mind telling me where, you know, the weapon is? I said, yeah, I think it was in my car. And he goes, is it okay with you if I go get it? And I said, yeah. And then, you know, he called my mom. So my mom came and got me and took me to Banner Hospital Thunderbird. So, okay. And I was admitted to the psychiatric ward for 5 days because obviously when you try to take your life, you can't just go home and sleep it off.
Yeah. How old are you at this point?
Just turned 30.
Okay.
But yeah, because that was April, because my birthday's in February. This was April of 2007.
Okay. What's your mom say? Like, do you remember? Like, what is your mom saying? Does she understand?
I think my mom was just so grateful that I wasn't dead.
Right.
I don't have children of my own, so there's a lot of things that I don't understand. So I don't understand what that probably like visceral feeling she had in her nervous system that one of her children almost died.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that my mom more than anything was just grateful that I was alive and that I was agreeing to go get help. Because I think at that time she could see that this was about more than just me drinking.
Yeah.
You know, especially because she'd been married to my dad.
Yeah.
And that's why she divorced him, because of his drug and alcohol problem. And she grew up in an alcoholic home. Her sister at one time was hospitalized because of alcoholism. So alcoholism is something that my mom's been very, very familiar with for her entire life. Yeah, I think, you know, she understood that there was more going on than just having her daughter having a drinking problem.
Right. And you mentioned that you struggled with depression for, mm-hmm. I mean, as long as you can remember.
Oh, yeah. Like you said. I think the first time I was prescribed Prozac, I was 15.
Okay.
I don't know if that was the best course of action. And I don't have a whole lot of recollection of how that decision came to be. I mean, I know my mom was noticing things going on with me and she took me to the doctor and I got prescribed Prozac, and I wasn't against it because I did want to feel better. I had kind of said to you that like, when I was looking for my next relationship, which is the relationship I'm in currently, I wanted to find someone who was naturally happy. And my boyfriend is.
Yeah.
But he also does not understand anxiety or depression at all. Yeah. And I firmly believe that the two go hand in hand.
Yeah.
I think that you either have more anxiety and less depression, or more depression and less anxiety. But I think that I've probably been ashamed of that because there wasn't as much awareness.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it was just kind of like suck it up and figure it out. Yeah. I mean, I graduated high school in 1995.
Yeah.
You know, I like to wow kids and be like, well, I'm older than the internet. And they're like, what?
What's that?
What? Like, what does that even mean?
It hasn't been around forever.
So people didn't really talk about it. Yeah. It wasn't, you know, it was just sort of like, well, figure it out. It can't be that bad, which that has brought a lot of guilt with my depression.
Right.
Because I do think, like, why? What do I have to be upset about?
Yeah.
Like, I have a great life, a much better life than a lot of people. And so it's been hard, but definitely something that for as long as I can remember, I've been trying to like cope with and navigate.
That was kind of like going to be my next question going to that. Cause you know, like at that, I feel like generation kind of, you know, you are just like, you're okay, get over it. Did you ever have that like sit down conversation with your mom where, you know, you talked openly about your mental health and how you're struggling and you know, like something is wrong?
No.
No.
I don't think I... No, and it's not that it was like, I don't want to say it was like a secretive family,
right.
I don't know, because my mom has also had depression. Right. So I don't know if maybe she couldn't navigate how to have that conversation with her daughter because she couldn't navigate her own depression.
Right.
I honestly, I don't know. And I think, you know, my mom and I, so just as adult women, my mom and I are incredibly different people. Mm-hmm. We have very different personalities. I don't know if maybe part of her felt like she didn't know how to even approach having that conversation with me.
Yeah. Yeah. So this night where she goes to pick you up because you've attempted, do you think that took her by surprise or like, do you think she like understood like, you know, or she's kind of like, what, why would you do that?
No, I don't think she was surprised at all because I had never gone to these lengths, but suicide wasn't something that I hadn't sort of danced around before. Part of her, I'm sure there was a shock of like, it finally happened. Yeah. Not that I think any parent ever wants to think in terms of like, finally. But
yeah.
I think somewhere in the back of my mind, my mom probably thought it wasn't out of the realm of possibilities that I may get to that point.
Right.
You know, because what I've tried to explain to my boyfriend is that when you are that depressed, you're in such a deep, dark place that the idea of trying to get anywhere near what is light is so mentally and emotionally overwhelming, you just can't.
Yeah.
You know, like you just can't.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like, you know, you'll hear those people that are like, well, it's just because like, you're so selfish. How could you not, like, you're not thinking, you know, like about anyone else. And it's like, no, you're really not thinking about anyone else. And it's so bad to the point where in your mind, like you truly believe you're doing everyone else a favor, you know, like you really are like, okay, you're welcome, you know, cause.
Yeah. And my aunt and uncle, they both passed, but they were in, they did improv comedy for many, many years. I mean, they had like regular jobs, but they got to work with Robin Williams. Mm-hmm. I think they met him in the 70s originally. So I didn't meet Robin, but he was someone that they talked about in a way that it almost was like he was a family member. And then when my aunt passed away, he came to her memorial service. So my grandma and my mom had a chance to get to speak with him and know him a little. And I remember one day, I can't remember what year it was, but I got a phone call from my mom. She said, are you sitting down? And I said, no, but I will. She goes, Robin. And she didn't have to say Williams because she goes, Robin died. And I go, what do you mean he died? She goes, he killed himself. And I cried because I was so sad, but I also felt like a sense of relief for him.
Yeah.
Which, again, you're right. People always think like that's so selfish. And I can understand that. But what they're not understanding is they're coming in from a place of their own selfish needs.
Yeah.
They don't want that person to be gone. But yeah, when you're in that bad of a place.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, I don't know. I don't even know if I can compare it to like somebody who gets in a car accident and they break every bone in their body.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, well now you have to do PT. And it's like, what?
Going back to this night, you say your mom picks you up and then she takes you straight to the hospital. And you mentioned that you stay there for a few days. After like kind of the shock, I guess, wears off of like, oh shit, that really happened. I didn't succeed. I'm still here. I'm in the hospital now. What are your thoughts?
So being in a psych ward for 5 days, not that I ever thought I was, but it helped me realize like I'm not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very interesting experience. And I'm not trying to offend anyone by saying crazy, like, you know, so I'm not really sure what other word to use, because I was there with people who have much more severe mental illness than I do. They took care of me, certainly, but it was almost like they're handling you with kid gloves, because
mm-hmm.
you've just done this thing that's so severe. And to you, part of me is like, I just don't understand why this is such a big deal.
Yeah.
Because to me, that was going to make me feel better. I mean, granted, I wouldn't be here anymore, but I also wouldn't be feeling what I was feeling.
Right.
So after the 5 days, I got out. My dad lives in Oregon now, but I think at the time he was still living in California. So he came out and I started going to AA, you know, and he took me to a few meetings because my dad had his share of experience with AA. So it was kind of the transition of like, okay. And so I had been working in the restaurant industry at that time. And then I left because I was like, okay, even though in the first 12 months of sobriety, they say like, you shouldn't make any huge changes. Don't change jobs. Don't move. Don't get into a new relationship. I needed to be out of the restaurant industry. And so I ironically got a job at the same hospital in their food service. A friend of mine was a registered dietitian there. And so I needed to have a job.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was living in an apartment with a roommate. So I moved out and I moved back home. I'm not back home, but I moved in with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for at least 6 months because I really just needed, in some ways, I needed to be in a space where other people were taking care of me, even though I was a grown ass adult woman. I was 30 years old. But I think once you get to the point where you actually try, like seriously try to take your life, there are a lot of steps that need to be taken for you by others to help you like navigate what's going on.
Right.
And oddly, I don't remember going into therapy. I went into AA, and I think that was more because if I hadn't been drinking, I don't know that I would have ever had to have the quote unquote courage to actually try to take my life.
Right.
Which seems so strange, but I think that if I hadn't had a drinking problem, I think like there would have been too much ideas about guilt and whatnot mm-hmm. that I wouldn't have followed through with right. actually trying to do it. I would have just continued to live in misery.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like it made it easier because, you know, it's kind of like numbing and gives you that little push of like, mm-hmm. okay, I don't want to be here. So
I'll right
here. Were your parents allowed to visit you at this facility that you were at?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And how was that? Like, do you remember them like coming to see you? And
yeah, did that it was, them? I mean,
were you in any way?
I don't have like super vivid memories, but they definitely came. They and my brother came to see me. I don't think they came every day because I was there for 5 days. So, I mean, you know, I was admitted and then they came the next day to see me because I think this was on a Saturday and the next day was Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
So they came and saw me and spent quite a bit of time there that day. And then I think maybe one other day, mm-hmm. you know, since I was there for 5 and then the day I was released.
Yeah.
My parents came and picked me up and took me to their house.
Yeah. Okay. That's really crazy because I don't know if you know this. I've shared online a few times, but I actually tried to commit suicide myself too. And I was admitted to a hospital this was in California, in 2014. I was 20. So I also did go to a facility and it was also Easter Sunday.
I knew you had attempted, but I didn't realize it was the same day. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so weird. Cause I remember, I think I was also in there for like 4 days, but I remember like, I don't know why I vividly remember it, like the Easter Sunday. Cause I remember just thinking like, man, my parents, like they had plans for Easter and here they are having dinner with me mm-hmm. with all my new friends.
Right.
But that's funny. That's just what a coincidence.
For sure. It is.
And then was the facility like you went to kind of like, because the one I went to was like split up. So it was like more of like kids that have attempted. But then there was like attempts that were like more, I don't know how to say it, like physical, and like people that got physical and like could not be like around other people. So it was like a more intense, like,
so I don't know if because it was a psych ward at like a regular hospital. We weren't separated at all. Like everybody was, to use a prison term, in gen pop.
Yeah.
Like, and when there was like, okay, we're having group. I mean, everybody was there. Would attend, but the level of contribution from people was different depending on what, you know, they were there for. I mean, like the roommate that I had was a woman who all night long, she would talk in her sleep in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I don't know Spanish. When she was awake, I don't think she even knew Spanish. She only spoke English.
That's interesting.
So you definitely had exposure to different people with different like levels of mental illness.
Yeah. Oh, that, wow. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Would you say like being in there kind of like helped you or like gave you different perspective on like mental health and suicide and all of that?
I think it gave me more perspective on how bad my drinking was and how badly it was impacting my life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think I really put the correlation of like, wow, your mental illness or your depression really is so bad. I think I just related it more to, you've got a really bad drinking problem and you need to stop drinking. I think probably because of the circumstances that I had tried to kill myself were surrounding alcohol. And I mean, you know, like I said, I got a DUI in 2004. So this was 3 years later. I mean, it's not like this instance was the only thing that had ever happened in terms of my drinking being a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I had many instances of problematic behavior. I mean, I came home in my senior year of high school wasted and got into a really unpleasant verbal conversation with my mom. So, you know, the effects, negative effects of alcohol had been going on in my life for quite a long time. Cause like I said, I was 30 when this happened.
That kind of makes me want to ask this question of, as you mentioned, you've got a DUI, you had a DUI and you got into like a little bit of trouble with the law. Do you ever feel like that kind of pushed you into like more of an addiction or more of a drinking problem? Cause you know, I think about it and like people who do struggle with alcohol or drugs and they get in trouble and then they get all these fines and then they get all these things, like, you know, it's just like one thing on top of another, on top of another, on top of another, that makes it so hard to kind of feel like you're out of it. Mm-hmm. Would you say that was ever like,
so
in your head?
My drinking didn't slow down when I got the DUI. I think I justified continuing by, well, I just won't drive anymore.
Yeah.
Other people can drive.
Yeah.
Like, that'll be fine. Yeah. Because I got my DUI in California. So I was still able to keep my license. I had to get an SR-22, but I never was without my driver's license. So I was always able to like drive and drive to work and whatnot. And it probably got a little bit worse because, yeah, I mean, that's like, oh my God, like I had, you know, because the court system values two things, or the court system knows what the two most valuable things are to you, your time and your money.
Yep.
And that's what they're going to take. Yeah. And so, yeah, because now it was like, okay, I have to attend these classes and I have to pay these fines and I have to go to court. I have to X, Y, Z. So yeah, I mean, I think even though like I have no one to blame but myself, I would drink to sort of, I guess, make myself feel better about this problem that I'd caused myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I asked that because I remember, like Eric owned his own business and he also had like DUIs and like felony DUIs for drugs and stuff like that, applying for things for his business, especially when we moved out to California, they're a lot more strict out there. It was hard for him because he's a felon or he has this on his record and all this stuff. And I just remember him talking about like, it's so hard for some people that are like do get in trouble and like are in the system to that want to start fresh because they always have this following them, you know, like you can't do this. You can't own your own business. Or like even when applying to jobs, like that's a question they ask. And it's like, okay, well, we're not going to hire you. And he would always kind of be frustrated with like, yes, I know I did this to myself, but like also we need help. We don't need to be punished more. We need another way to like be punished, but be helped out at the same time, not just adding more to the punishment.
And I think, you know, that is, I think, why a lot of people become repeat offenders.
Yes.
Because they can't figure out a way to make it, you know, on the straight and narrow.
Yeah.
So they go back to what they know because that is a viable option for them. So I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if maybe take it like, okay, yes, I have a felony, but it's for this thing. Is that going to have anything to do with what I'm doing? No.
Right.
Do I have a felony for murder or molesting a child? Okay, absolutely not. Then you all go to an island.
Yeah, like, and,
you know, but I don't remember it necessarily impacting me in that way. Mm-hmm. Mine wasn't a felony DUI. I think I blew a .12. Mm-hmm. So obviously well over the legal limit.
Yeah.
I don't know what's considered a felony DUI. I don't know if it has to be double. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But I think his was more because, you know, there's paraphernalia and heroin and stuff like that. And then I think he did get like in an accident, not with anyone else, but with himself. So they also charge you for harming yourself.
Okay. That really they do?
They do.
Yes. Interesting.
Yes. So if you get an accident and you're intoxicated and like you break your bones or like you hurt yourself, you will get like a felony. I don't know, like, I don't know what, depending on what the charge is, but for bodily injury against yourself.
Interesting.
So I feel like that also like fucks with some people because it's like, okay, I didn't hurt anyone. Like I hurt myself.
Right.
You know, and it just, yeah, like you said, I don't know the answer. I don't know like how to fix it, but I do feel like obviously there's issues in our justice system and like ways that things can be handled and like better handled. But, yeah. So I kind of want to talk about now you told me that addiction impacts people in your family. And you mentioned to me off camera that your brother struggles or is he clean now?
So he's clean. He had a heroin addiction.
Yeah.
I think it was probably so surprising for our family because growing up, my brother was like this all-American kid.
Yeah.
You know, like good looking kid, played sports, was popular. I mean, so he didn't explore until after he graduated high school.
Yeah.
And I think initially it was Soma.
Okay.
Which was like sort of what led, you know, like that's what the first thing was as far as his introduction. And then it just progressed from there. Mm-hmm. He's on Suboxone now.
Yeah.
So he lives a clean life. I mean, I have mixed feelings about Suboxone just because I do not have a lot of knowledge where when someone's on Suboxone, their doctors have some sort of schedule to taper them or wean them off, which to the point to eventually not be on any kind of a drug.
Right.
Because Suboxone is still a form of an opiate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do people who take Suboxone live a much better life than when they're in full-on addiction? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, my brother wouldn't hold down a job and he wouldn't be as good of a father and, you know, all of those things. So it's definitely tough.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, what do you want? Do you want a full-blown addict who can't do anything?
Yeah.
Or do you want this person who is a functioning, contributing member of society? But yeah, I mean, and he was in rehab multiple times. I almost think he went to rehab because that's what was expected.
Yeah.
Or if you don't go to rehab, X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's hard for a lot of people to hit rock bottom,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's drugs or alcohol. Mm-hmm. It's a tough thing because you then have to really be prepared to like look at yourself in the mirror. And I mean, metaphorically and literally. Yeah. And that is a very tough thing for people to do because in my experience, nobody is a drug addict or has a drinking problem because they just like to be drunk and high.
Right.
There's something that has happened, something they've been through, something they've experienced, and this helps them either forget about it or come to terms with it or feel okay about themselves, right, regardless of having experienced that. And so now, if you're going to get sober, you have to fully acknowledge that this thing happened, along with all the other things that you have done over the time you were using,
yeah,
which is oftentimes very embarrassing and shameful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really, that's so true. Use it as like a blanket, I guess, right? Like you don't, like, it's helping you cope with these things. So once you stop using, it's so hard because you're like, oh my gosh, I like actually have to feel these feelings. And it goes back to what you were saying with like being uncomfortable. Like you have to sit with yourself and you have to be so uncomfortable. And I'm sure for addicts, it gets to the point where it's like, oh my gosh, but I could be feeling this instead, you know, like I could like so easily not be feeling all these feelings and go back to that. That was one of Eric's things. Like when it was always when we were going through, like when he was going through something really big that he just didn't know how to handle his emotions or his feelings, like financial, like if we're having financial problems or like having a baby, you know, like these big, big life changes where it's like, okay, you don't know how to sit with yourself and deal with it. So this is your way kind of out and like to blanket it and to do that. How long has your brother been on Suboxone?
I think it's been around 5 years. My brother and I don't have a super close relationship. So to be completely transparent, a lot of the time he was using, I wasn't really in contact and I wasn't really asking my parents what was going on because I'm not going to enable him.
Yeah.
I just wasn't, you know, and I know I'm sure plenty of people would be like, oh my God, that's so harsh, but I just wasn't. And, you know, as a parent, you just don't know. I don't want to say when to walk away because that's a terrible way to put it, but
it's so true.
You want to continue helping your kids. But I mean, so if you have helped them go to rehab 10 times, and I'm not saying that this is how it was for my brother, but I'm just saying they've gone to rehab 10 times. They're stealing from you.
Yes.
You know, like you're draining your retirement savings because you want them to get better.
Yeah.
At what point do you, as a parent, say, I guess we've done all we can? And yeah. I think a lot of parents just can't reach. I think they feel like they're going to betray their children.
Yes. Or like failed, right?
Right.
It's like the acceptance of, I can't do anything else. I can only imagine how hard that part is as a parent.
Right. And obviously your job as a parent doesn't quit when your kid turns 18.
Right.
But over the age of 18, there has to be some sort of expectation that they, as an individual, take responsibility for their actions and their choices.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. But yeah, it is hard, like seeing the person you love doing that. But, and it's funny because I always say, like, if Eric were still alive, like I'd still be here and I'd be doing this, you know, like again and again. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, but at what point is it too much to like keep enabling, I guess, in a way, you know, because it's like, okay, like, you know, you can do this and then I'm still going to be here and your kids are still going to be here and we're going to be here. But like, yeah, it's just, it's really hard to know and to kind of know when to walk away and when enough is enough.
My guess would be that for a lot of people, it's probably when their kids get to be a certain age and they go, okay, now this is having the negative impact. It's a much bigger impact.
Yeah.
And so,
and just thinking of that makes me so sad. Cause like, I can't see that. Like, I don't know.
Sure.
You know, because like,
he was such a good dad.
He was such a good dad. And like, Emmy like idolized him. And it just like breaks my heart to think if that were to ever happen, it would, I don't know. It's just sad to think about. But also at the same time, I think what keeps like some people going is the fact, like Eric was very much like, I do not want to do this. Help me, please. Like wanting to be out of it. And I think also knowing that he was clean for you know, a certain amount of years and then just like constant, like, I don't know. Like, it's pretty fucked up because, yeah, he would be like hot, like using for a month and then he'd stop and then a few months pass and then, you know, but I never went through a phase with him that was like more than 2 months. So I don't know what that's like. I don't know what it's like loving an addict for a long period of time
right.
Because it never was a long period of time for me. So I think that's right. kind of what also made me like keep going was like, okay, you don't want to do this. And then you're clean. And then you use for a month or, you know, and mm-hmm. then you're clean. So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's different for everyone.
No, for sure. And I feel like it's, if you have children, it's either to a point where it's like, okay, this impact, or you just yourself are like, I can't do this madness anymore.
Yeah.
Like I really can't, because now what we are doing is the definition of insanity.
Yeah.
The same thing over and over. Yeah. And I don't know that it's expecting, but hoping.
Yeah.
For a different result, like hoping that this is a time they're going to go, okay, you know what? All right. Yeah. I'm going to stay sober and I'm going to do it this time. Yeah. Like,
and this is going to be the time where it's going to last, you know, a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's hard. I want to know where you're at today. What does life look like for you today? How is your relationship with your parents?
I've never actually had a close relationship with, anyone I've been related to. The closest relationships I had were my maternal grandmother and my aunt, my mom's sister, and they both passed away. My aunt passed away in 2008 and my grandmother passed away in 2012. So, you know, I am my mom and my dad's only child, but I've really never had a close relationship with my dad. He lives in Oregon. I talk to him every few months.
Mm-hmm. And is he still an alcoholic?
No. Okay. He quit drinking. It's been a really long time.
Yeah.
Probably like 20 years or more. I joke that he substituted Jesus for alcohol, but he's not pushy though. But he's very, you know, he goes to church and he really enjoys that. And I would much rather have him doing that. My mom and I, it's trial and error.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're coming to a better place of having more of an understanding that we are just two incredibly different people and how to navigate still loving one another, but understanding that there really has to be boundaries that we stick by.
Yeah.
And somebody told me years ago that boundaries are not for other people. They're for you.
Yeah.
So, and that's a hard thing, you know, because when it's someone you care about, especially like a parent, you don't want to, I mean, I don't want to hurt my mom's feelings, but at the same time, I understand like in order for me to be my best, boundaries have to exist.
Yeah. And I feel like that's also hard if the other person doesn't understand that part, that boundaries are not like, it's not anything I have against you. This is for me. I feel like some people take it personal.
And so she's understanding more. I mean, she does understand boundaries.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's just, I think it's been really hard for her to just have a child that is so different than her. You know, but my relationship is really good. I picked terrible partners for many, many years. And that, I am 100% convinced, was one of the part of the collateral damage of my drinking. So I'm in the healthiest relationship I've ever been in with a super wonderful man. And I am on medication, but it makes things more manageable, you know? So I don't, not every day is great, but I try to have more of an appreciation of things, because I believe in, you know, the secret, like what you're putting out is what you're getting back.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I mean, I've heard that our brains don't know the difference between when we're being sarcastic or joking. So if we say, well, I'm just going to say it, but like, if you say like, oh my God, I'm so stupid, why did I do that? Your brain doesn't know that you just are feeling that in the moment. Mm-hmm. Your brain just knows that you think you're stupid. So I try to be, you know, have more positive thoughts and just not have as much negative self-talk, because it becomes kind of like second nature.
Yeah.
But really, I'm not stupid. I'm human and I made a mistake.
Right. But actually being able to tell yourself that now instead of like dumb and then brushing it off. You know?
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. What would you tell someone right now that is struggling with the fact that they just no longer want to be here, that's struggling with suicidal ideation and thinks that the world is just a better place if they were not in it?
So I would first say, take a deep breath, be willing to give yourself some love, and call someone. If you have a family member that you can call them. If you have a friend you can call them. If it's your boss at work, if it is the National Suicide mm-hmm. Prevention Hotline, call. What you're feeling is 100% valid. I don't want anyone to feel like I'm diminishing, but I think that when you start to have those thoughts, it's very easy for them to overwhelm mm-hmm. and overcome you. And having perspective there is invaluable. And I think be brave enough to tell the person, like, I just need you to listen to me, mm-hmm. or maybe you need them to sit with you,
yeah.
but don't be afraid to say something.
Yeah.
I understand it's scary. I understand it could scare people, but just don't be afraid to say something.
Yeah. Adding to that, if you are somebody that somebody calls with that problem, I think the main thing is you don't need to fix the problem. Like you said, sitting with someone, it means mm-hmm. like so much. Not even, you know, we don't have to talk about the problems. We don't have to fix it. Just sit here with me so I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps so much with, like, I just feel like that in itself is so much, because then I won't go and take a whole bunch of pills or, right. you know, slit my wrists. And just having somebody there is a very big thing.
And for the person receiving, if you're the one who's getting the phone call, the text message, let yourself be uncomfortable.
Yes, absolutely.
I think that as a whole society, we could value in learning to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's not going to be easy if someone's reaching out to you, but try to think of it as feeling blessed
yeah.
that they trust you enough to reach out to you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I remember after Eric died, I had a couple people. Literally two people. Because I mean, man, when Eric died, I was suicidal pretty often. And there was a couple of people I could call and be like, yeah, I think I'm like about to kill myself. Mm-hmm. And they'd be like, okay, you know, and then just like talk about like something else, or like, you know, like not talk me out of it, which is like a big thing. It's just being there and being like, okay, well, like, do you want to go get ice cream first? Or, you know, like, it's just a big thing of it really does mean so much just being there. And not fixing the problem. So is there anything you want to add?
Nothing's coming to mind. I mean, I feel like somebody will probably get something.
Oh, from a lot.
Something I had to say. And I hope they do.
Yeah.
I really hope it makes people feel better and okay
yeah.
about whatever they're
yeah.
going through.
I feel like you sharing your story is just a big... we don't know what everyone's going through, right? And when you got here, I mentioned everyone has a story. Mm-hmm. Some people are like, oh my gosh, like mine's not, you know, like it's nothing crazy. But to other people, that same situation is so big. And just by sharing your story really helps so many people know that they're not the only ones going through it, you know?
Because it's not like I got a huge catastrophic accident and that's how I got my DUI. Right. I don't know. I mean, was fired in a really traumatic way from yeah. a job or repeated jobs or anything. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of people who live the same kind of
yeah.
life
yeah.
that I have lived and was living when I was drinking,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
and I hope it makes somebody feel more
yeah.
seen.
It absolutely will. And I just want to thank you for taking the time out of your day and
of course
sitting here with me and yeah. telling me and all of us your story. I really, really appreciate it. And then hopefully that helps someone else want to
right.
speak their truth and tell their story. Cause I
yeah,
feel like
absolutely.
Just talking about it just lifts weights off of your
yeah I think shoulder. When we're struggling the best thing we can do is talk about
yeah.
it, because the more you get in your own way and the more you stay in your own head, it's rarely a good place
yeah.
to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Rarely. I so. agree. Yeah. And I feel like that's why I'm like super open with my kids too. And like, I want them to tell me everything and be uncomfortable. And I'm constantly like, when my kids are like, I'm bored, like I want to watch TV, I'm bored, I'm like, nope, it's good to be bored. Like, go
yeah.
sit with your brain. They're like, what do I do? I'm like, I don't know, but you'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then like 20 minutes later, 10 minutes later, they're like doing arts and crafts and building shit on the table or like coloring. And like, I don't know if you saw this little like desk in the entryway mm-hmm. of my, they put that there and they play hotel and they like check each other into, it's like they're using their imagination or
right.
they're like sitting with their feelings. It's like, I feel like that's so important to teach from a very young age.
Oh yeah.
because then, yeah, you get like us, you get into your adult years and you're like, oh my gosh, this is so bad. Like, I don't want to be here. Like, the quiet is so loud and I don't want it.
Right. Right. No.
100%. So yeah, that's very important. Yeah. Again, thank you so much. And thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. If you want to continue to be a part of these conversations, like, comment, subscribe, share, all the things. I do want to mention, like Anne Marie said a little earlier, there is a national suicide hotline. So if you're ever feeling alone or whatever the case may be, you can call or text 988. Also reach out to a friend, do anything you possibly can. Just know that the world is better with you in it. And don't forget, just for today, keep going.